Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sine Yanoğlu. I studied neuroscience and then bioengineering, graduating with a PhD from ETH Zurich in Switzerland. Currently, I'm working in the diagnostics industry. Today, I have with me Agustin Fuentes to talk about Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You, the second edition. Agustin is a primatologist and biological anthropologist. He graduated from University of California, Berkeley, with a BA in anthropology and zoology, as well as an MA and PhD in anthropology. He has since been researching fields of biological anthropology and primatology, exploring the entanglement of biological systems with the social and cultural dimensions. He began his academic career at Central Washington University and most recently served at the University of Notre Dame in a number of different roles, including director of the Institute for Scholarship in the Liberal Arts, as well as professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology. Since fall 2020, he serves as professor in the Department of Anthropology at Princeton University. In the second edition of Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You, Agustin covers three pervasive and pernicious myths about human behavior: that humans are divided into biological races, humans are naturally aggressive, and men and women are wholly different in behavior, desires, and wiring. Agustin tackles misconceptions about what race, aggression, and sex really means for humans and incorporates an accessible understanding of culture, genetics, and evolution that requires us to dispose of notions of nature or nurture. Thank you, Agustin, for joining us today.
Sine, thanks so much for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
So let's maybe first start with, so this is the second edition of the book. What has been going on in the past 10 years that prompted you that we need a second edition for this book?
What hasn't been going on the last 10 years? Look, the book is about understanding human nature. It's about genetics, biology, sex, gender, war, peace, aggression. The last 10 years are, if they're basically nothing but those things all the time. So I think it's important. I think what really stimulated me to write a second edition is that we're in an incredibly rich and amazing time of technological and theoretical advances in science practice and practitioners. So we're seeing who's doing science is changing or expanding, and the capacity to do more and more detailed science and to develop more and more sort of copious volumes of data. So I think things have changed a lot. And in particular, in regards to human biology, from the genomic level to the organismal level, in regards to our understanding of patterns and processes of aggression and violence, and in our understanding of what human variation looks like and why people misuse that in horrific racist ways, the last decade has seen explosions in all of these areas. At the same time, I think we've seen regressions or more ignorance about race, aggression, and sex than almost ever before. So it's the perfect moment to take what I thought was a really good book in 2012. It took me about 6 years to really pull it together then, and to just really update it, engage it, revise it pretty extensively for the current moment. So 2022 was a moment when we need a lot more information, better crafted arguments, and more access than we did in 2012.
And also looking at the research, so you actually pointed out very well, on the one hand, there's an explosion in the research with regards to understanding these various aspects of what we call human nature. And at the same time, there's, let's say, a deafness to it, right? You also mentioned, because there's basically in the culture itself, so if I may say, then there's a regression. So just very briefly, what do you think is happening here?
Well, I mean, we all are living through it right now. The world, right? The planet, many different nations, many different societies are undergoing incredible duress, incredible stress. And in these times of stress, we see different kinds of movement towards fascism or totalitarianism, social control, strife, because the inequality, inequity is so huge, anger, blaming of others, fear, insecurity. All of those things come together and create a very, let's say, a perfect condition for lies, manipulation, and fear to really take over people's lives. And so we're seeing that, I think. I think we're seeing a doubling down on a misuse of information about human biology to control, to scare, and to hurt other people.
And the theme of, for example, not believing the science or not believing in the scientists and kind of looking for easier explanations, this is actually not something new, right?
No, it's very old. But here we have two, maybe even three problems. First of all, there's a strong anti-science sort of reality right now. And that's old. People are nervous about. And there's a good reason, right? In some ways, a lot of science is very complicated. But another good reason to be nervous of the science is throughout the last couple centuries, science and scientists have misused information about humans, lied about humans to harm, to control, for racist, sexist, colonialist perspectives. So a lot of people mistrust scientists, not because of science, but because of the political and historical realities around a lot of science. And the third thing is that there are active scientists still doing this misuse. There are people with advanced degrees who believe strongly that white, black, and Asian are different kinds of humans, that men and women have very specific 100% different realities, and that at the heart of us, we are aggressive, violent creatures. And they're going to present information in a way that makes you believe that. So I think all the three of those things are happening right now. And the real challenge is, how do we take all of this incredible knowledge, data, and analyses, which are out there, which are great? I mean, this is an incredible moment in science, right? Even in spite of something horrible like the COVID pandemic, our understanding of, for example, how to model viral sequence evolution, I mean, that it's expanded. Our understanding of human physiology is changing. So there's all this great information. But how do we take that from the research labs, the universities, the private funded pharmaceutical companies? How do we take all that knowledge and provide it to the world in a way that's accessible and understandable? And I know this book is difficult in some ways because there's a lot of notes and a lot of information, but I'm hoping I at least made a little bit of inroads in making it accessible to people.
Yeah, I would definitely say also I'm familiar with more biological aspects of scientific, writing and so on, but I found it actually, it should be understandable. And about that, actually, about biology and what we have been just discussing, this comes again and again also in the book. So for example, genetics. So this is something that has really settled in the culture. So I really liked that you at the beginning, it was one of the toolbox to, understand all these myths and so on. It's quite funny that genetics, so it's in the genes and it's hereditary. This really stuck in the culture and everything that came after. So they're also, even in research or even in scientific education, this is taught as, for example, central dogma of molecular biology. So we kind of admit it, right? That it's a gene, then a protein, then there's a phenotype and so on. And however, the reality is much more complicated than that. And maybe we can talk a little bit about this. There's epigenetics, there are other aspects, but there's also this resistance to go for a very simple explanation, which genetics and the central dogma type of genetics, and then, you know, ignoring all the research and by now quite established research on other things that play there.
Well, the funniest thing here is that there is a truism, right? There is a fact in the world, and all biologists, especially all geneticists, know this. And that fact is genes do nothing by themselves, right? Now, that's not a surprising statement. I mean, that statement is almost so like basic, it's meaningless, but it's so important because the way we talk about genes and genetic sequences in the public, but really genes, because the public doesn't think of genetic sequences, they think of this thing called the gene. And also in the academy, is as if there were this thing in the human body that produces behaviors and ideologies and patterns. And that never happens, even in the most sort of clear-cut, like mistake gene diseases. So when you have a mutation or a deletion that causes a malproduction that has a molecular, you know, cascade, even in those cases, it's almost never that there's just one change and one outcome in a 100% consistent. It does happen, but it's very rare. So my point with that whole genetics, I had to put in, that's a whole new chapter. That genetics chapter is a whole new chapter because we got to the point where the misconnection between the data and analyses and understanding of genomics as processes and the public and many academics' idea about what genes are is so huge that I just say, okay, look, here's what we know in a very simple way. And this is not to say that DNA, that genes are not really important. They're central to everything. Everything has some genetic connection to it, but not in a line, right? Not usually directly causal. And it's always dependent upon all these other contexts and relationships. So when I say a gene does nothing by itself, that's actually really important. And we should start teaching genetics that way, but that's not what we do.
No, not at all. We stopped at central dogma about being critical. And then
the power is so important because people think, oh, well, genes, like, you know, someone spits in a tube, pays $150 US and expects to be told who they are. Right? Any geneticist knows your genes don't tell you who you are. They tell you some very important information, but they can't tell you, they cannot tell you whether you're Swiss, right? Or, you know, Spanish, or, you know, Moroccan, or those are nationalities and histories and societies and associated with languages and particular traditions and practices. So those things are not only related to genetics.
And that theme also, again, is a lot, is quite present. Like, basically, what makes a human is neither fully, you know, culture or fully biology. So it's what you call nature neutral.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I got in trouble because I invented a word, but I couldn't. That came from, you know, 20 years of teaching this topic. By the time I published the first version of this book, I'd started using nature neutral because I was just so frustrated. I would say it's not nature or nurture. It's not nature and nurture because the two don't exist without each other, right? That's it's always nature nurtural. So people just shake their heads when I say that, but the point is valid, right? We can make up a new term, but I want people to recognize that, you know, for all of human existence, right? The individual existence and throughout human evolutionary history, this dynamic, this biocultural dynamic, this dynamic between bodies and histories and societies and other animals, you know, all of that dynamic is always ongoing. And to pull stuff apart, I think it harms our ability to get a big picture understanding.
And I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, but I guess it's difficult because it doesn't stick as the easy answer. Like, it's a constant back and forth, constant interplay. And again, this comes in the book that, like, certain things, and especially like evolution, also you take in this context. So you, maybe we could actually from here really go in that direction, and maybe you can unpack a little bit. I really also enjoyed that, I have to say, the myths about evolution, because like the genes in genetics, this is also one thing. Also, it penetrated into the language that, you know, you talk about evolution of things. So what do we misunderstand about evolution?
So I think that the biggest misunderstanding about evolution is that everything is showing up the way it is for that purpose, right? This whole idea that whatever we have was evolved that way. So I use the book Candide, Voltaire's little novelette Candide, for an example, because there's a philosopher in there named Pangloss who always says everything is for the best, right? So we evolve basically in a nutshell. We have two legs. We wear pants. And people tend to think, oh, perfect. We perfectly adapted to wearing pants. Right? Wearing pants has nothing to do with evolving two legs. It has everything to do with us covering ourselves and having two legs. And so building the culture to map to those two legs. What I'm trying to get at here is people think evolution is very goal-directed and targeting, right? So everything happens for a reason. And the truth is everything doesn't happen for a reason. Evolution is very, very messy. Some things we can model and understand. Other things have so much complex histories that they've shown up for a variety of reasons. Now, that's not a great explanation. That's very confusing. So I'd rather put it this way. Evolution is change over time. How things change over time, there are a bunch of different processes. There's natural selection, there's gene flow, there's genetic drift, there's niche construction, there's developmental plasticities. We know how things change over time, and we have models for how those processes shape life, including our own. And I think that's very important. So evolution is this really dynamic, not always goal-directed, messy, beautiful, wondrous reality that has produced the plethora of life. And it's ongoing right now, right? We are all humans have been evolving, are evolving, and will continue to evolve. The second big problem with evolution is people think we come from monkeys, right? I don't know, you know, that's really all of it. People are like, oh, humans, you know, you have a monkey, then you have sort of a chimpanzee looking, then you have sort of a something between a chimpanzee and a human, then a human. That's not the way it works, right? I mean, anything that's around living today is equally evolved. What's amazing about evolution is that it tells us about the history of life and how we relate to other parts of life. And so evolution is about continuities, what we share with all other life, especially those branches close to us, like monkeys and chimpanzees. It's also about the discontinuities, what is distinctive about each lineage, right? And so that's what evolution is. And so what I try to do laying out is just talk about how does evolution work? What is it? And then knowing that, we can then talk about human biology, human history, and human futures with a little bit more understanding.
Yeah, and it fits also very well when you explore the myths, because like some of them also arise from the fact that the way how the cultural, how the society is organized culturally due to politics and different powers at play, people tend to think if, you know, is this made for purpose type of thing? Oh, like then the explanation is easy. It's like this because, you know, biologically they're this way. So.
And let me give you a good example that's in there all the time. If you look at, let us say, here in the United States, same in Switzerland and in many places, if you look at most of, although it's been a little different in Switzerland, but if you look at the vast majority of presidents or heads of the top corporations, they're one particular kind of person, or they look in a particular way, right? What we would call a white older man. And so many people have argued, well, look, the majority of presidents or prime ministers, the majority of business owners of major corporations are older white men. That means there must be something about being a white older man, and it's evolutionary, so they're smarter, they're more capable. And that's when you step back and talk about this nature-nurture. Well, you know, what cultural, historical, political, and economic realities have shaped that? And are there really differences? Can you take a 60-year-old man and a 60-year-old woman and say, here are brain differences that make one better at being a business leader and the other better at being a school teacher? No, they're not. So that's where biology comes into play here. It tackles and disrupts the myths that we think explain the world, but then opens the door to other explanations, which are just much more complicated.
Well, I mean, when we also talked earlier about the, you know, scientists and they also have opinions, right? So they do science, and they do science also from a personal lens. I think sometimes this is also what we miss a little bit. And at the same time, in the past years, I see like there is more diversity in scientists, which basically gives us this many, many different diverse lenses, which is definitely enriching what we also can find out. Because if you have had a different experience, I think there was an anecdote also in the book, like two people looking at the same thing, especially for observational sciences, you'll focus on different things, you'll see different things. So also kind of having a society kind of trying to move towards giving everybody opportunities, everybody a chance to, you know, for example, it's also already a privilege to have the chance to, you know, devote your life to science. This actually is not so easy to do for many facets of the society, right? So,
So this, I mean, that's great. So you bring those things up. A couple things I think very important. I mean, we know, and there's tons of data, and I cite a lot of it, but there's tons of data that show that more diverse, more inclusive research teams produce, on average, better outcomes because of the diversity of experience and perspective. So there's some really good methodologically important stuff. But really important, I like what you said right there, is that, you know, scientists, right, are humans. So science is practiced by humans. That means it has biases and problems, stuff like that. And that's why I opened the book by giving a little ethnographic, autobiographical narrative of myself. And it's funny because some people are like, well, that's very arrogant. You open the book by talking about yourself. And the reason I do that is because I want the reader to know who I am. What are my biases? I'm very clear about my biases. Of course I'm biased. I try my best to present data and information, but of course I'm biased. So I want the reader to know who I am, where I'm from, where my schooling's been, what my experiences are in the world, to shape sort of who I am. So what they read, I don't care if they believe me or not. That's beside the point. I want them to understand what I'm saying. And I provide all the references and a little bit at the end of how to go find information for themselves. I don't want people to believe me. I want people to understand me, right? And understand this information and do with it what they will. So I think that's really important. And something that really I did intentionally with the second version, which is something I think is very important in the practice of science. And that is, I thought a lot. So I included, I think it was like 130 new citations, 150 new citations, studies, and, you know, just as updating everything. And a lot of new analysis and review things that I know that I cited, but I intentionally thought, okay, who am I going to cite here? Who, you know, I really thought, you know, I cited what was the most important work for a particular thing. But when I talked about reviews or reflection pieces or different research groups, I made some choices to highlight scholars doing the kind of work that I think is more equitable, more just in many ways, and often much more interesting. And so, you know, that there's a power in that, right? Getting, saying, look, here are the different types of people, different groups, different processes doing this. Now, one could equally criticize me. I don't cite a lot of race realists. I do cite them because I attack them in the book or show how they're wrong. But, you know, there's a lot of, so I guess that's not totally true. I'm going to back up. I actually do cite a lot of the people I totally disagree with and I think are wrong, because you have to read them and understand what they're arguing, but then I deconstruct their arguments. But you could say a bias of mine is that I am not interested in reading a lot of racist and sexist pseudoscience. And so I don't cite a lot of that unless it is to show how it's wrong.
Well, I mean, one also famous scientist who, like, I think we're coming, and I'm very happy about that, a little bit more questioning, is Darwin. So, like, he is very beloved all around, but after all, he's also human, right? So, and now he also was living in a particular time and in a society with certain norms and values, and basically he. It's a setback, that is, let's also be honest about this, with regards to gender and gender roles and understanding. He was looking and basically not seeing
I've done that research and written on it. And then, as you know, back in 2021, I was asked to write an editorial in the big magazine, it's called Science, for the 150th anniversary of Descent of Man, the really important book by Darwin, one of the important books. And I wrote a critical editorial pointing out that this is an amazing book, that Darwin is an amazing scholar, he's a genius. Darwin is one of my heroes, absolute heroes. But at the same time, in Descent of Man Sexual Selection, it's a two-volume sort of big book, he lays out, especially in Chapter 7 and the chapter on race, and then the other chapters on sex, he lays out incorrect, clearly racist and sexist perspectives, right? And there's two things. He was an English man, right, of a particular time, right, mid-19th century. But he was also a genius scientist. And what's amazing in the other work, the longer work that I've done, I lay this out well, is that you read through his work and you can see the genius scientist and the English man fighting with one another in Darwin's head. But he always let the English man win when it came to race and when it came to sex. And that's unfortunate. And so, you know, I like to say at the end of this recent publication, I had it, you know, if Darwin was alive today, he would be writing a very, very, very different book, right? Because the data are just so overwhelming. But that's the lesson about the bias in science. That doesn't mean we get rid of Darwin's insights and the important part, but we do recognize that there are many, I would argue, racist and sexist scientists, and then a wide number of the public who are also racist and sexist, who want to use Darwin to say, see, Darwin said that, so it must be true. And that's why we need to read Darwin critically in these ways and think through this, recognize his genius, ability as a scientist, but also recognize the biases and constraints that growing up, as he did, created in his mind, and to remind us how powerful those biases are. So even though you read his chapter 7 on the races of man and descent of man, you read through that, and he keeps saying, well, you know, human variation is like, none of these things that we say about race are actually biological. They don't seem to be functional. They didn't evolve by selection. It just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, Europeans are better than Africans. And it's just like, well, you just demonstrated that's not true, and yet you come to it at the end. And that's the power of bias in science. And we're just more aware of that now. And so we can't let it go. You can't let it go. This is a new age, right? We need to call these things out.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, as we discussed, so basically all the scientists are also human. There, we can look at it more critically and, you know, also have a little bit of, and this is also something you touch upon, have a little bit level of education to kind of judge a little bit like where this might be coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is what's so important, because what I try to do in this book is lay out the data. Like, here are the data. There are, and this is one of the things that the first edition was criticized. I'm sure they'll criticize this. It's like, there are too many footnotes. There's too many, you know, I try to keep them out of the way, and they're just little numbers in there. But, you know, many of the chapters have 140 footnotes or something. And that's because when I say something, I have to say, here are the 3, 4, 5, 6 papers where this comes from. Here's a few notes on it. And I can't not do that, because that's the way science should be done. We should be very clear and overt. But also, data, the way the world is, has to drive scientific discussion, right? And I think what's really happening now around issues of human variation, whether it be racial or sexual, about human violence and aggression, one of the biggest problems is many people, even people working in these areas, don't know what the data actually look like. They don't read across the entire range of things. And so they're making arguments that are very limited. And I try in this book to give the broader public and students access to the data so they can do the work for themselves and then decide how they want to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's just much easier to check 1, 2 things and the, like not having the comprehensiveness that you provide in the book. So, I mean, thanks for that. So it's really just to pick up and, you know, get, let's say, open the doors to a vast, vast scientific world. I would really, really recommend it.
So picking it up. So the way I wrote it, too, if you'll notice some of the early chapters, I mean, you can read it all as a sequence, but you can also pick up any chapter out of nowhere, just open it up and read different parts or different things. I tried to make it, you know, you don't have to go start to finish. You can go backwards and forwards or just pick out chunks. And that, I hope I did. And I tried to fix the writing a little, or improve the writing from the 2012 version, which I think is very good. But I want it as much as possible to be readable, right? So much science, so much important science is inaccessible because it's written in these, you know, research formats that, you know, no one but 12 people can read, and that's just not good.
How big of a challenge was that? So I want to also go through the myths, but like before that, since we came to this point with regards to scientific communication, how big of a challenge, like what do you personally experience in trying to write a book that communicates very complicated, not straightforward, with many buts type of science to the public?
I mean, that, you know, that's the, that I think my entire life has become that attempt. I think I tried to do this well because the challenge is to be honest, be truthful, right? Be comprehensive, and not be, but be as accessible and as understandable as possible, because nothing about the human is simple. Anyone who tells you there's a simple explanation for why we do whatever is wrong. I'm just going to say that, right? That there are almost never simple explanations, but there are fascinating explanations, right? And so that's why I say, here's the culture toolkit, here's evolution toolkit, here's the genetics toolkit. I try to make toolkits so that you can then, like, the minimum, you have a minimum understanding of what you need to do to talk about the rest of this stuff. So I'm sure I don't succeed always, but what I wanted to do is make the writing interesting, make the writing as accurate as possible, but also invite the reader to sort of think with me, not just listen to what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it works. So let's then, maybe I wanted to also briefly dive into these three myths that are covered in the book. So the first one is race. And why is race as a basis in biological, in genes or whatever, is a myth? But why is race so important in the cultural context for us to discuss?
Well, I'm writing this book from North America, from the United States, where this is sort of one of the most problematic issues. But it's the same in Europe, and it's the same around the world. But I use a lot of examples from North America because I think it's very specific, and the UK as well. So why is the race myth the problem? Well, the myth is that humans are divided up into three or five clusters, right? Black or African, white or European, Asian or yellow, these ridiculous terms, or maybe Native American or red. And, we're drawing from Linnaeus's classification, right, 300 years ago. So that's the assumption that people have, that these categories are biological. And that is untrue. There is not a biological category of black or African or European or white or Asian or yellow. Those are not biological categories. Those are social categories. Now, that doesn't mean they're not real. Right. For example, if you walk down the street in New York or in London or in Zurich, what you look like is going to affect the way people treat you. Right. And different societies have different ways of classifying people, but all societies classify people, and race is one of those. And so we think of skin color, hair type, different sort of facial features. People think these skin color, hair type, and facial features are biological characteristics, but they think they unify people into these biological groups called race. So race is not biological, but it's still real as a social, political, and historical thing. And let me just be very, very clear. Let me use those examples. So skin color, dark skin, black skin, incredibly dark skin, occurs in multiple populations of humans across the planet, right? In Africa and South Asia and Southeast Asia and Australasia and Polynesia and South America, right? That skin color does not unify any one group of humans, aside from the human species. The same with hair types, the same with eye color, the same with face forms. So it turns out that there are no biological characteristics that lump people into black, white, Asian, or those kinds of categories. But again, those categories are real. So how do we explain that? So what I try to do in the book is say, okay, look, race is not biology. So let's show, we can show how that is. Let's talk about the genetics. Genetics don't get us race. Let's talk about skin colors, talk about blood groups. Let's talk about height and weight. Let's just take all the biological facts about humans and just walk through them. And lo and behold, they don't get us race. But then we still have race, right? And racism, bias, and discrimination against people because of who we think they are or who they get classified as. Why do we have that? And then I talk a little bit about those things, like the racism is real. And so racism is an anti-evolutionary and anti-biological way of seeing the world, right? And that's what I wanted to show. So the myth of race is that it's biological. That's disrupted. I can throw that out, but we still have racism. And so then understanding the social, political, and historic realities of why we still have racism, that's the real challenge, right?
But there's still some misuse of science. I mean, there are at least scientists trying to, or like pseudoscience, as you put, trying to kind of find a basis in science. How do we fight these type of attempts?
We do the scientific analysis of their positions, right? When someone says, no, Africans have lower IQ than Europeans, you're like, break it down. Okay, what are you talking about? What are your categories? What's your IQ measure? What you attack and dismantle the argument, which we can, because biologically that's an absurd statement. It doesn't work that way. And none of those things mean what they think of it. So we can do the academic. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand is we yell and we act and we teach, and you don't let people get away with that, right? Racism is anti-biological and anti-evolutionary. And as a biological scientist who's interested in evolutionary processes, I'm going to sort of do everything I can to make sure that doesn't happen.
So should all of us, I think.
Yeah.
Anybody get away with non-scientific things.
When I teach or lecture, interact with a group, 50 10-year-olds, they can get this like that. I can teach it to them. They'll get it. 50 20-year-olds, that's much harder. 50-year-olds, it's almost impossible. And so early education is where we need to go.
Yeah, that's right. And thanks a lot for this brief summary into the race. This was one of the myths. So how about aggression? So this is also quite prevalent, and yeah. I'm a bit puzzled why.
Yeah, there's this incredible sort of belief that emerges from the heart of the Western Academy, the entire Western education system and philosophical system, that resonates from some of the Greek scholars right through Hobbes and Kant, and I mean this sort of major philosophical heavy hitters and again, all guys too, so let's keep that in mind. But this idea that at our heart, if you strip away the veneer of culture of civilization, we are beasts. We are violent. That especially men, right? And that's actually the idea that humans are naturally violent, especially men. That's a scientific hypothesis. You can test it. Let's look at the data. So we look at the data, and as you see, I'm not going to be able to go over everything. But what's really interesting about the data is it's not that clear. Yes, more men are in prisons. More men kill others. More men. Rape and murder, but most men do none of those things. So it's this very interesting, complex relationship. So we'll get to the male-female thing, but right now, what I try to do with the aggression is, what is violence? What is aggression? Show how complicated that is. To say that humans are very aggressive, that actually means nothing. What do we mean by aggression? There's all these different kinds of aggression. To say humans are violent, what do we mean by that? So I break all that down, then I walk through the sort of neurobiology, the hormones, the muscles, the bodies that are associated with violence, and say, well, what do we actually know about this? And at the end of the day, I can clearly and scientifically accurately state humans are not the most violent or the most peaceful. We can be both, but we're not by nature either of those. We have a whole bunch of range of potentials, right? So we can be awfully violent and horrible, but it's not some like adaptive thing. It's not how humans evolved. We did not evolve just to be violent.
So as you say, it's basically a range of, many different maybe like emotions or states. So like, wouldn't it be funny to say like it's the most happiest of all?
Right. We are, right. Humans are the happiest of all the mammals. Well, we could be that. We're also the strangest, but that's a whole other. No, but here's my example. See how complicated that, I tried to do that in a nutshell, but like the aggression thing is really complicated because it's not even a thing. Aggression is actually not a thing. Are you talking about fighting? Are you talking about being mad? Are you talking about hitting someone after they hit you? Are you talking about feeling bad about someone? Are you talking about being angry at your mother or being angry at a friend or being angry at someone you don't know? All of those things are actually different processes and patterns. So let's break it down. Let's do the science. What do we know? And at the end of the day, at the end of this chapter, as you notice, I'm like, wow, it's really complicated. But it is nature nurtural. And that's the take home. Right? It's this dynamic interplay between biology, bodies, cultures, histories, and our individual lives.
Then it's actually a good segue to the sex and female and male. So that's definitely biological why more males are in prison, right?
Well, no, what's really funny is that there are more human beings as a percentage of the population. There are more people in the United States in prison than anywhere else in the world. So you could say biologically, people from the United States are much more or much worse. No, it's not true. We have a historical and political system, but let's put that aside for a second. So the sex thing, the sex and sex gender, and you'll see, I really did a lot of work updating this. Here's one of the biggest problems. Whenever you say that it is a myth that males and females are totally different kinds of things, people get all upset and they say, oh, you're saying men and women are the same. I am not saying that. I never say it. I say again and again and again through the chapter, all humans are not exactly the same, that men and women are different in many, 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 many ways, that males and females are different in many, many, many ways. But the overlaps, where the differences and similarities are, is actually much more interesting than most people think. And that's the whole argument. It's just like humans are one species, right? Then there's the biology of sex, which is really interesting and dynamic, but it's not totally two different things. It's actually this really interesting overlap and patterns with really important differences, right? You know, pregnancy, lactation, birthing, certain hormone and physiological profiles, really important for understanding bodies. There's lots of differences, but those don't necessarily always mean what people think they mean, nor do they biologically map the way people think they do. So at the end of the chapter is where the real throughout is updates, but I have a bunch of new even terms in there where I talk about the contemporary way of people who study sort of sex in humans talk about sex gender. It's just like nature neutral, right? The biology and the culture are always together. And what's amazing in humans is it's actually quite varied. We have this really interesting sex gender system, this nature neutral system about our bodies and our lives and our families and our, you know, sexualities. It's just fascinating relative to most other animals. And that's what I try to get across. So the myth that I bust is that men and women are from two different planets or different kinds of things, or I'd say males and females. But the answer to the myth is, wow, it's really complicated. And there are many ways to successfully be human.
That's great. That's also a great message. Like, we should just embrace more diversity and just be happy of, you know, like that people are.
But we should understand yeah. What is the diversity? Like, what is the diversity? You know what drives me crazy is that in our own lives, we know this. Either it's in ourselves or our friends or our family. Everyone knows. Like, just think of the, you know, 25 people you know well. Tell me there's just two kinds of people.
Exactly. No. And as you said, in our lives, like, you just appreciate to have that. When you have a friend who is, supportive, you go when, you know, you're upset, and another one is, you know, like, great fun, and you go out and so on. But like, you kind of, as you said, you appreciate it on a, you know, personal level. But then it's when it comes to explaining things, and I guess this is also this a cultural thing that we have, we want to put things into boxes.
Right. Boxes. Yeah. We are not boxy. Right? Humans are not in boxes. And so, but the thing I really want to drive home here is understanding these accurate descriptions of human biology and the human variation and where humans vary and where they don't is really important for things of health, for things of mental well-being, for, you know, relationships. I think it's really important. And it's funny because I've been criticized lately. I'm actually working a lot on this project by arguing that the differences aren't the way we think they are and that there's more variation. People say I'm arguing there's no difference and that I'm disrespecting women I'm like, wait, that's not at all what I'm saying, right? And I think the last thing I want to say, or at least I think very important, is that male and female are biological terms, but man and woman, those are human cultural realities. They're all nature neutral, right? And so how we talk about that and how we engage that, I think is really important. So the differences and the biological patterns are so important. But we have to remember that we're all human, and that should be where we start.
That's great. Thanks a lot. My last question is about, will there be a third edition? And this is a question you can take as a little bit of forecasting, a little bit of magic, you know, like this also part of culture, looking, you know, in the future. Do you think we will need... Maybe it's a good thing because there will be this boom of new science and that you would want to include that, you know, helps us understand things much better. But at the same time, culturally, will we still be in trouble that, you know, we'll need a third edition to tell us again and again?
So you just outlined my conundrum here, right? The difficulty I'm having, because I think it would be great if there was no need for a third edition. Right? If we sort of figured this stuff out really well. I wrote this second edition because the world needs it. I think the world needs it right now. We need a better conversation. We need better understanding. I would love if in 10 years we were in a better place than we are right now. I'm not that optimistic. I hope things get better, but I don't know. So having said that, I'll revisit this in 7 or 8 years and see where we are. But I want people to read this book and, again, not agree with me or believe me, but understand what we're laying out, what what's out there in the world. How do humans vary biologically, and what might that mean?
Yeah, I also tend to agree with you that I think maybe we'll speak in 10 years, huh? Again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Augustine. This has been great. It was great hosting you here. And I, as I said, I would encourage everyone to pick up the book and take a look, as you said, like even like read a few chapters.
Thanks, Ine. Very, very enjoyable. Bye-bye.